In March, the wind blows down the door and spills my soup upon the floor. It laps it up and roars for more, blowing once, blowing twice, blowing chicken soup with rice. My introduction to an intellectual food life, a curiosity about food that went beyond eating it, came early. Who else read Maurice Sendak and wanted to taste chicken soup while riding a crocodile down the chicken soupy Nile? As I began to read novels without pictures, food descriptions or scenes of set tables and dinner parties were some of my first lessons in differing economic classes. We are what we eat, right? Adrienne LaFrance took a look at some of her favorite descriptions of food and literature for The Atlantic. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure, especially since this is one of my favorite subjects. You talk about one of my earliest experiences with food literature, Maurice Sendak's Chicken Soup with Rice. And I have to say, even though I was already nine when I encountered it, it tickled me, probably because the dish itself was omnipresent in my house, and to see it travel the world kind of opened me up. How old were you when you discovered that tiny book?
I mean, I think I was reading it before I could read. I remember it always being in my life. And the book, it's a set of books from the Nutshell Library that are so small that it always just felt to me like, you know, a special secret just for kids.
Absolutely. So let's talk about class for a minute. You cite Gustave Flaubert's Sentimental Education with its wild descriptions of opulent meals as a favorite. Perhaps you could just read us a little snippet that you quoted in your article.
Yes. What's funny about this one is I remembered having read it the first time around, these opulent descriptions. And of course, the main character who originally comes from the country but has moved to Paris is sort of semi-horrified by the opulence. And I had this memory of when he's back in his hometown, there being like really wonderful descriptions of bread. And then I went back and reread it, and that's not the case. So I must have sort of in my own thinking about class in this novel, I had sort of imagined what the food in his hometown would have been. But in any case, what the book actually contains and is very striking are these descriptions of these festivities. And you have one dinner party that's held in a huge room, and it's, quote, hung with red damask and lit by a chandelier and candelabra. And then you see the sort of menu that the guests are served, and there's champagne-drenched sturgeon's head and roast quail and vol-au-vent bechamel and red-legged partridges and potatoes mixed with truffles, and it just goes on and on. And there's another scene where people are, like, you know, shooting long jets of wine at one another, and birds are flying around. And so it's just this totally over the top, very memorable descriptions.
I remember as a young person reading novel descriptions such as these and just being amazed that people lived these lives. There was something about learning about people through food in novels that I just ate up. Sorry. But it's true.
No, it's really interesting, though, because I actually didn't start noticing food in literature until much later. And I don't know why, but there was something about the first time I read The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle by Haruki Murakami. And this was after college. This was like, I don't know, I was in my 20s. And his descriptions of just these simply prepared but delicious sounding food just totally blew me away. And from then on, I became obsessed with, like, when I'd notice it in a novel or in other forms of reading, I would notice it. But to me, Murakami was sort of like this awakening for me.
Do you have an example for us from Murakami?
I do. Let me pull it up. This is so good. Okay, so this is from The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle. And the main character, Toru, is sort of waiting for his wife to come home from work. And here's the passage. At noon, I had lunch and went to the supermarket. There, I bought food for dinner and, from a sale table, bought detergent, tissues, and toilet paper. At home again, I made preparations for dinner and lay down on the sofa with a book, waiting for Kumiko to come home. Not that I had any great feast in mind. I would be stir-frying thin slices of beef, onions, green peppers, and bean sprouts with a little salt, pepper, soy sauce, and a splash of beer, a recipe from my single days. The rice was done, the miso soup was warm, and the vegetables were all sliced and arranged in separate piles in a large dish, ready for the walk. I just love that. It just sounds so good.
you say that his descriptions can take the mundane and make it somehow magical, take the real and warp it into a dream.
Right. And part of that is, you know, in the context of Murakami's writing writ large. And so you're in a novel that's already surreal and strange, and you as the reader are sort of trying to get your bearings. And then you come across a passage like this where it's just like, the guy goes to the store and buys toilet paper and then makes some stir fry. And it seems so ordinary, but it's beautifully described, all while this very strange mystery is playing out in sort of the narrative arc.
You know, I love that you mentioned Brodigan, because it's been so long since I've read him. And you talk about a scene in which he describes the intimacy of a cup of coffee.
Yes.
And how it allows the mind to kind of quietly roam.
Yes. I love this because, I mean, I love Brodigan generally. And I loved this example because it's not just that descriptions of food and literature are memorable because they sound delicious. So much of it for me is being able to accurately capture the place that food occupies. And in this scene, in this story, it's the scene of a breakup or a man sort of going to visit his former lover, and they have a cup of coffee. It's like instant coffee, nothing exciting. It really speaks to how food can be a crutch, or just, you know, the ways in which food appears in our life that, again, seem ordinary but get sort of imbued with meaning.
And one of the things that I really love about what you described from Nora Ephron, you're talking about her description of making a ricotta pancake. My favorite part of that description is how she casually mentions the off-gassing from the Teflon pan.
I know. She was so funny and so cool. And so reading I remember the first time I read this essay of hers, and, you know, it ends with a recipe for this pancake. It's like, oh, I have to make this pancake and be like Nora Ephron. And of course I tried and like did a terrible job and it wasn't very good. But you're right. Like the humor with her, it's always the sort of one-liner, the self-deprecation, or just, she was so funny.
So funny. And like tempering the joy. Like you couldn't just enjoy that ricotta pancake.
Right.
And for me, I mean, the quote from Italo Calvino, who you characterize as having a dreamer's eye, the way he describes the act of cooking, I think is one of the greatest descriptions ever of the act of cooking.
Yes, I love it. It totally captures the romance of how we think about food. And the way he describes it is this, the handing down of an intricate, precise lore. And for me, of course, as I was reading this, I was thinking about my Italian grandmother and all of the recipes that she, you know, that I was near her while she made and that I have now tried to make myself. And Calvino is writing about Mexican food, but it's really, it's the sense of the personal and the ancient, even for something as present tense as eating a meal.
Well, thank you so much, Adrienne.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Adrienne LaFrance, the executive editor of The Atlantic. You'll find a link to her essay, The 12 Most Unforgettable Food Scenes in Literature, on our website. Head to kcrw.com/goodfood. Are you hungry? Well, Bill Addison is here next with a recommendation for terrific Shanghainese food in San Gabriel.